Well, hello, everyone. I'm Alicia Swamy. I'm here with my co-host, Eric Johnson, Keely Severson. We are exposing mold. Today, we have Dr. Nick Money with us. He's a professor at Miami University. He's an expert in mycology and has authored a number of books that celebrate the diversity of the microbial world. In his research at Miami, he has pioneered the use of high-speed video microscopy to understand the explosive mechanisms used by fungi to launch their spores into the air. His latest book, Nature Fast and Nature Slow, How Life Works from Fractions of a Second to Billions of Years, examines the lifespans of the oldest organisms on the planet. So, thank you so much for joining us, Nick. I'm really happy that you decided to come on the show, and we look forward to this conversation.
So good to meet you, Alicia.
Yeah, it was wonderful to meet you as well. So what I want to know something really important. What is happening in modern fungal biology, and what is the fungus among us up to these days?
What is the fungus among us? Wow, it's a broad question. So one of the many hats I wear is as a I'm one of the editors of a journal called Fungal Biology. So it's an international journal, and it's got a very broad scope, very broad compass. So that allows me to see papers that are submitted from all over the world, essentially, on all kinds of different topics in mycology. So that probably does give me a fairly broad view of what's going on in the field. So what's going on in the field? There's a lot of interest right now in fungal pathogens that affect humans. I mentioned that just because there have been some outbreaks of some particular diseases, illnesses caused by fungi in the United States and elsewhere just in the last few weeks and months. And these are getting a lot of news attention. Attention from the media. And so that's one thing that is interesting, this phenomenon of large numbers of fungal infections or some clusters of these fungal infections. That's one thing that I found interesting. And then among academic researchers that are looking at fungal biology, there's a lot of work, and there has been for many years now, in looking at the evolutionary relationships between different species of fungi. So that's not something that I'm engaged in directly, but I find that work interesting, thinking about evolutionary themes, how these spectacular organisms have emerged over time. So those are a couple of, you know, immediate highlights, I suppose, would be, yeah, clusters of fungal infections, and then this ongoing and broader interest in the research community on the origins of the fungi and where we get the source of the diversity of these organisms that we find today. But we could pick on a lot of other topics, but those are certainly the two areas.
Sure. Yeah. I know I am aware, and I'm sure you are too, of the blastomycosis outbreak in a paper mill in Michigan. Is this something that you were referring to earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned that, I suppose, just because I've just been reading about that. So it's very newsworthy and very interesting. I mean, it appears to be one of the largest, if not the largest, outbreak of blastomycosis in North America. You know, perhaps as many as 100 patients. It's really, really interesting. I mean, so there must be a source within one would imagine there's a source within the workplace then of the spores of this fungus. But that number of cases is pretty interesting. You've got something that's got, you know, some degree of virulence. It's able to affect probably quite a diverse population of workers, different ages, different health status, and causing these infections. So yeah, and there's some different ideas about why this might have happened now, and then why we're seeing some other outbreaks of different fungal diseases. I mean, it's sort of horrible, but, you know, fascinating too from a scientific perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's so many different things going on with the candida. How do you say it? Is it Tropicalis auris?
Candida auris is the other thing. It is interesting that these stories are making it into tabloid newspapers now and getting a lot of hits. So people are really interested in these stories, and there's a number of reasons why that's so.
Yeah. There's so many different things happening, like that one, and then the secondary mucor infections in the COVID patients and increasing that. I mean, what's going on here?
Well observed. I mean, that was really interesting, wasn't it? These infections in India and elsewhere. It's really brought fungi to public attention, perhaps more than before. Which is good in terms of raising awareness about fungi and fungal biology, the way that they interact with our bodies. There's also a more cynical point of view, which is that is it The Last of Us? I haven't watched it. The documentary that this has made everybody pound very interested suddenly in fungal diseases, and so many professionals in my field have had different. Media contacts about, what do you think about this? And so, the suggestions that they make in that show are obviously outrageous from a scientific perspective. But, it's making people interested in mycoses, fungal infections. And it's still, if you look at all microbiology textbooks with a clinical perspective, just any microbiology textbook, the fungi get a chapter if they're fortunate, but most of the text is dominated by bacterial and viral pathogens. But the fungi are tremendously important and perhaps becoming more so.
So is it true, is this rumor true, that fungus and bacteria are fusing together to create superorganisms? Are they sort of separate in their own sort of kingdom of organisms on this planet, or are we seeing just this sort of evolution of them coming together?
I wasn't aware of that. I mean, so the fungi and bacteria, they occupy very different parts of the evolutionary tree, the phylogenetic tree, right? Very, very, very different. Bacteria being simpler cells. Prokaryotic cells, we say, so they lack a nucleus. Fungi being a lot more like us with a more complicated cell structure. But what sort of resonates with me in relation to your comment there is that there's a lot of work on interactions between fungi and bacteria in the human body and elsewhere. So fungi and bacteria they're everywhere. They're everywhere. They're in us. They're on us. They're also in the environment. And so they're interacting all the time. And so there is a lot more interest now in the chemical communication between fungi and bacteria, which can mean lots of things. But they're sometimes competing for the same resources, the same food. So they're acting in an antagonistic fashion, fighting for the same calories. And then in other situations, we see examples of, I don't like to use the cooperation, but that's what it is. They're working together. They're not actually actively fighting and sort of coexisting in a particular environment, which might be indeed in some human tissues or on some human tissues. So, I'll scratch my nose here. And I mean, there's fungi there in the form of yeasts, and there are also bacteria. There, we're walking ecosystems, and I think with the increasing sophistication of genetic techniques, we're actually able to figure out really what's present in these different places, and then probably we're just in the early stages of understanding how they're interacting. So it's an exciting field, no doubt about it.
That's interesting. Thank you for that. It's not just fungus that seems to be increasing. A lot of these fungal infections are on the rise. So are bacterial infections, et cetera. How does that speak to the ecosystem? Is this a climate change thing? Is this we're too sterile in our environment type of thing, where we're kind of, killing off the good microbes and making room for the bad microbes? Is this an issue with our agriculture, with the use of, a lot of insecticides and glyphosate and different pesticides of that nature? Like, what's going on in our landscape that are changing these different organisms so that way they're now actually harming us and you know, also other plant life and wildlife that we're seeing.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I mean, your kind of list of contributing factors, I think, is pretty perceptive, because it's really all of them. All of these things may be having a role in these interactions with microorganisms. You mentioned using pesticides and other compounds in agriculture, and that's interesting. We also use fungicides in agriculture. And so there's beginning to be more concern about the way that the use of these compounds that destroy fungi on crops may be leading to the evolution of fungi that are resistant to these compounds. And the problem there is that we use some of the same drugs to treat fungal infections when they're, you know, affecting us. And so this raises the possibility of the emergence of drug resistant strains of fungi that might represent a greater threat to humans. So that's one thing that's really interesting. Now, another thing that I find fascinating is the way that we've introduced antifungal compounds into all of our lives, our daily lives, and our hygiene routines, bathroom routines. I don't know what the word is. Thinking about using anti-dandruff shampoos like Head and Shoulders and other products, that these contain an ingredient that specifically inhibits the growth of fungi that grow on the scalp. And so, I mean, and the market for dandruff shampoos is immense, and millions, tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of people globally are using these compounds. And I find that kind of interesting too. I mean, could we perhaps see or find examples of resistant strains of fungi that are beginning to beginning to work around these compounds? Because they're everywhere, right? You know, they're in the shower, on our head, in the shower drain every morning. And this is another way that we're manipulating the microbial world, the microbiological world. And this is going to affect the future trajectory or evolutionary trajectory of these organisms, if you're playing with them to that degree. And then if you fling in all these other factors, I'm actually not sure about climate change. That's one idea that's been put forward, that maybe climate change might be one of the factors that has increased the prevalence of these very virulent fungi. I'm really not convinced with the data there. So yeah, climate change is definitely occurring, but the effects in terms of the average temperature is pretty modest. I don't think that's significant enough. It's just my sort of gut feeling that this isn't significant enough to be driving sort of major trends in fungal evolution. But I mean, I could be persuaded otherwise. I mean, there's the idea there, and stop me if I'm going on too long. I mean, the idea is that perhaps as the planetary temperature in the biosphere increases, that we'll see fungi becoming better able to deal with higher temperatures. But actually, most of the fungi are able to deal with warmer temperatures than we find now. So I guess I should qualify that a bit. Changes in climate are having profound effects upon the distribution of fungi. But when we look at the kinds of fungi that grow on the human body, they can cope with some pretty warm temperatures. Temperature isn't really a limiting factor, I think, for their growth a lot of the time. Well, not these sort of modest changes that we see in the environment. I didn't explain that as beautifully as I would have liked, but anyway, I'm a bit of a skeptic when it comes to the effects of climate change on human pathogens. But that doesn't mean I'm a climate change denier.
I know, no, I get it.
Years ago, actually, we didn't publish this work. We played with a lot of fungi, so they were both clinical isolates from us and. Not us in the lab particularly, but from clinical isolates from patients, and then actually looking at fungi that we'd isolated from the external environment, and just seeing how they coped with quite warm temperatures. And most of them did really pretty well. So I don't think the obstacle, I don't think the human body temperature is much of an obstacle to the growth of a lot of fungi.
That's interesting that you say that, because there are articles coming out where they're saying because of the human body that our body temperatures are becoming lowered, that it's paving the way for opportunistic fungi to take over. So what you're saying, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, that's another possibility. We're looking at pretty modest changes in temperature. Yeah, yeah.
All right. I would love to switch gears here and go into mold. In one of your book titles, man, you have a really great just library of books that you have written. I honestly want to go and buy them all after this conversation, because I was like, wow, this guy's really cool. So you had mentioned that mushrooms are considered fungal sex organs. So what are molds in relation to fungus then?
What are molds? So molds, we use the term mold to describe fungi that grow with, first of all, that grow with a filamentous form. So we can look at the two major ways that fungi grow is either as these filaments called hyphae that extend at their tips. Look, I'm doing hand puppets here, that extend at their tips and branch to form a colony or mycelium. So that's one way that a fungus grows. The other way is as a yeast cell that's producing copies of itself by producing buds on the surface. So we've got yeasts and molds. And the way that the term mold is usually used is to describe these filamentous forms of fungi that are not going to go on and produce a mushroom, something that's visible to the naked eye. So there are these microscopic fungi that are growing in the form of these filaments or hyphae. And they're everywhere. They're everywhere in the environment. They grow on every kind of surface. They grow in every habitat. They grow on land. They grow in water. They grow in seawater. And they grow on us also. So, yeah, they're a really important part of life on Earth. But because they're microscopic, we're able to disregard them a lot of the time.
So when did you first become interested in mold?
Well, so when I was I turned 60 last year, and I became fascinated with fungi when I was as an undergraduate. And I grew up in Britain and went to Bristol University as an undergraduate, and I got hooked on fungal biology through this inspiring professor at college. So back in the early 1980s, and my specific interest in mold developed later. So I studied a number of different subjects in fungal biology, but I got really interested in mold, or particularly molds in the indoor environment, in the 1990s, late 1990s. So this was an example of a time when fungi were in the news all the time, and there were the And at that point, I'd moved to Ohio. And so we had this outbreak of cases of lung bleeding in children in Cleveland. And so that got my attention, very fungal and mycological story in my adopted state. And so that's really where I became very interested in these fungi that can grow in the indoor environment. Yeah.
So yeah, that 1994 Cleveland pulmonary hemorrhage incident was what really put toxic black mold on the map. So what do you think of the toxic black mold?
Well, I thought a lot about it over the years. And so if we think about those particular cases in Cleveland, so the idea, one of the ideas at the time, and I got to know some of the researchers that published this work, one of the ideas then is that these molds that were growing in, it was very poor quality housing in that part of Cleveland, that they were producing mycotoxins, and it was the tissue damage to the lungs of these infants that were inhaling lots and lots of fungal spores in their homes that was responsible for the lung bleeding. And so there was a plausible cause and effect relationship that was put forward there. But then probably, as you know, over time, there were some criticisms that were raised about that work. And so what? So we're in a position now, I think that there's relatively little, there's relatively little interest, I think, in that idea that, that mycotoxins were responsible for lung bleeding. But what's interesting there is that we don't really have a, we don't have a another competing hypothesis. So for me, it remains an unsolved medical mystery. It's really, really interesting. And I've read a lot of papers over the years that have looked at this from both sides, saying, yeah, mycotoxins were the issue here, and others that do a pretty good job of refuting that possibility. So yeah, that's sort of my background, and that's sort of my interest in fungi that sprang from the 1990s.
As you have stated in your book, CDC epidemiologist Ruth Etzel, who was working with Dora Dearborn on that case of the pulmonary hemorrhage, couldn't find any real common denominator that stood out as a possible culprit for this until she remembered a lecture in which a particular toxic black mold was mentioned, Stachybotrys.
Yeah.
And she checked the houses and did indeed find that it looked like Stachybotrys atra, as it was known at the time.
Yep.
Was something that could possibly possess the pathogenesis to account for this lung damage.
Yeah, that there were strains of this Stachybotrys then that were producing actually a broad range of mycotoxins, and they saw that as the, they then made that, it's a hypothesis, but a causal link between exposure to those, the spores of that fungus and the toxins, and then the lung damage, and
that occurred. And Ruth Etzel and Dora Dearborn put out a paper proposing this as a possibility.
Yep.
It wasn't a study, it wasn't an actual study. It was just proposing that this could be causal for this. And yet, when the Center for Disease Control decided to cast doubt, they kept condemning this as if it were an official study that was poorly contrived and inconclusive. And as I recall, no matter how many times they pointed out, it's not a study, it's just an idea.
Yeah, yeah.
They were still condemned as if they had done a study and failed to prove their case.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, there were a lot, there was, yes, there was that original study, but there were also a lot of other studies that were published around that time based on those Cleveland cases that, what, perhaps put forward a stronger viewpoint and sort of more clearly attempting to implicate Stachybotrys in lung bleeding. But yeah, I mean, we can look back on that, you know, it's more than 20 years ago now, and it's, we still really don't know what happened to those children, what actually caused that. Obviously, they were seriously injured, and was it one or two of the infants actually died? And yeah, it's a awful and fascinating unsolved medical mystery, I think.
Well, Dora Dearborn managed to get much substantiation from other sources for this type of lung damage, and yet the specificity of Stachybotrys was not revisited. Instead, the inconclusive nature of the early studies was pointed to as reasons that no further work should be done.
Yeah, I know. I'm well aware of this. I mean, at that time, or a few years after that, I actually got funded by National Institutes of Health. We had a three-year study, and we were looking at Stachybotrys from a more biomechanical perspective, which is something that interests me, rather than sort of looking at the effects of mycotoxins on human tissues. But we were interested there in actually how Stachybotrys spores actually get airborne. It was a fascinating period of research in my lab. But yeah, so I mean, I was involved in that peripherally to the clinical work, but we were very, very interested, or I was very interested in Stachybotrys at that time. Yeah.
So how do they get airborne?
I mean, so that's another thing. I spoke about this a few years ago. We found it really, really difficult to actually get spores of Stachybotrys into the air. This was this is a paper that was published, as I said, years ago. But we did work with these. We were putting Stachybotrys, cultures of Stachybotrys grown on different building materials, and I put them in little tubes, and we were exposing them to quite strong airflow under different conditions. And it was fascinating work. I mean, you'd see, here's my model of a Stachybotrys. There's the stalk. It's a thing called a conidiophore. Then there's a clump of these sticky spores on the top. And we see these things. It's all done under the microscope with digital video cameras. But we'd see these spore stalks waggling around, and the spores wouldn't get airborne. And I'd keep cranking up, or the students would keep cranking up the airflow until finally we'd get some of these things to move into the air. But it is fascinating that a lot of these fungal spores are quite sticky. They're not really, really good at getting airborne, which is why when we do indoor air quality studies on homes that are damaged by molds, including Stachybotrys, that we don't tend to find lots of high concentrations of Stachybotrys spores. It's a lot easier to find things like Penicillium and Aspergillus. I mean, there's usually much more growth of Penicillium and Aspergillus, but their spores are smaller. They're not sticky, or they're not as sticky, so they tend to get in the air more easily. But Stachy's a real that's interesting too. That's another, I would say, partly unsolved problem is the distribution of Stachybotrys, because its spores are so sticky. You find with fungi with sticky spores that they often seem to be, I mean this in an evolutionary sense, designed to be distributed by insects. So you'd find ants and other insects that feed in homes moving around, and actually spores get stuck to their legs and their hairy bodies, and the insects are actually moving things around in the indoor environment, and as they do outdoors. But that's interesting. It's another question about Stachybotrys that isn't properly resolved, is actually how this thing gets around. But I mean, carry on.
Well, have you found a mechanism that specifically causes the release of these spores?
No, I mean we actually did some work using, looking at insects, and certainly Stachybotrys gets moved around by insects, but in terms of actually getting into the air, that's a more problematic issue. And certainly I've done work on these explosive mechanisms that get spores airborne, but these don't seem to apply to Stachybotrys. But one of the things I do, I mean, I'm an academic and a writer, but I also work as an expert witness in what lawsuits related to indoor air quality. And yeah, I see reports sometimes with quite a lot of Stachybotrys spores in the air. And I do wonder, you know, how are you getting airborne? How do they actually get into the air? But
speculation is that the greater pathogenesis is from the fungal fragments that the desiccated spores and toxins eventually turn into fine dust, and that's the actual source of the illness.
Yeah, that's one idea. Absolutely, that mechanism of exposure to mycotoxins is through these fragments. I mean, it's not demonstrated. It's not proven. I mean, even the fragments are sticky, so it's still an issue if you've got a microorganism that produces these sticky compounds, that actually how their stuff gets into the air. It's lots of interesting ideas. And I mean, yeah, that fragmentation idea had some currency around the time of the Cleveland cases, but I want to see more evidence before I'd say, yeah, that's the answer.
Well, have you looked back on other suspicious outbreaks of sick building syndrome for the possible presence of Stachybotrys?
Yeah, the thing is, we've never, that's one thing when the cases in Cleveland were reported all those years ago, I was thinking, this is something that's worth watching. when are we going to get another outbreak of cases of lung damage in infants associated with the growth of Stachybotrys? And that hasn't happened yet. There've been a few reports, but not anything like that. This cluster of cases that was identified in Cleveland all those years ago. And yet, I mean, Stachybotrys is everywhere, just not in lots, you know, not in high concentrations. I mean, I could find Stachybotrys. I should make a bet and then I'll regret it. I could find Stachybotrys in anybody's home. If you know
that's what John Banta says.
I could find it anywhere. Yeah. So I actually thought about doing this years ago. I'll probably go to prison for this one. I thought, you know, I could go to a, why am I doing this? I've never done this. I will never do this. You go to a hotel, right? You go to a hotel complex, go to Vegas for the weekend and say, you know, I just found Stachybotrys in my hotel bathroom. You're going to have to give me, some privileges in the casino this evening, or this is going to be reported. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. I mean, you could go into, I'll go into Elon Musk's, one of his many mansions. Yeah, you give me a few minutes, I find Stachybotrys. And the best place to look is actually in if you've got indoor plants, and look under a plant pot after it's been watered. You can find Stachybotrys. It's one of those ubiquitous microorganisms. So just the mere presence of this thing doesn't tell you anything because it's everywhere.
Yeah, it almost seems like something happened to alter its fundamental properties, turn it from something that's everywhere and not particularly harmful to savagely pathogenic.
In terms of definitions, when we talk about something being pathogenic, we're thinking about it. Usually we're talking about it in terms of infectious disease, something that is actually growing in human tissues. And actually there have been a few cases of Stachybotrys doing this, so causing an infection, a mycosis, but that's not what the Cleveland cases were about. In that case, it was a mechanism of exposure to these natural toxins. But in terms of what made that case different, well, there was a lot of Stachybotrys, huge quantities of this, presumably in those homes. And so even though this fungus doesn't get airborne very easily, if you've got a ton of this stuff in an indoor space, and then you've got an HVAC system or some source of airflow, that might be getting a lot of these spores into the air. That could be what happened in Cleveland. It's certainly unproven, but plausible. But when I've done building inspections over the years, I mean, I used to do more of this. I didn't used to see vast areas of drywall covered with Stachybotrys. There'd be other fungi there, but I've seen a few cases where there was an abundance of this thing. You don't, once you do this, you don't even really, of course, you need a microscope or you need other techniques to demonstrate that Stachybotrys is present. But I think I'm the mold whisperer. I can tell Stachybotrys just from the color, just with the naked eye. So it's got quite a distinctive appearance when you see it growing on drywall.
Can you sense it?
No. But I can.
Well, it was in 1994 when the first indications really emerged that, in terms of pathogenesis, that we're switching over from infection to thinking of this as a purely toxic problem.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you this. So as a child, I grew up in Britain. I suffered from pretty severe asthma. And fortunately, as an adult, and, you know, I've lived in the United States, as a proud citizen of this fair nation since the 1980s. And so two things there. First thing is that asthmatics, if they're fortunate, after they go through puberty and they get older, sometimes they outgrow some of their asthma symptoms. But there's also a phenomenon too of actually escaping the source of your allergies by emigrating, as I did. And so I very rarely have any allergic problems or asthmatic symptoms here. And I've forgotten what I was talking about. Oh yeah, but there are some homes that I visited or buildings that I visited over the years as a consultant that were so heavily contaminated with molds that they made me feel pretty sick. I am assuming in those cases that it was that they were stimulating, you know, an immune response, you know, related to my sort of underlying allergies. So in terms of not sensing these fungi, yeah, fungal spores are one of the dominant and really under-recognized causes of asthma and childhood asthma, perhaps in particular. It's interesting. We talk about, you know, pollen counts, but there's not enough attention paid to molds. On the other hand, if you look online in your, you know, whatever zip code, you'll see mold and pollen counts for my area. We look at Dayton, Ohio. They've got a center there where they make measurements every day, and you can look at it's about an hour from where I live, and you can look at daily pollen and mold counts, so you get an idea. But I think I'm going off on too many tangents here.
Well, you brought up something really interesting there about immigrating from the UK to a drier climate for your health. And that was actually brought up in 1985. The Dr. Stephen Strauss of the NIH got into a big fight with Dr. Paul Cheney of Incline Village. And that was something that Dr. Strauss wanted to pursue, whereas Dr. Cheney was interested in a viral causality for what they were starting to call Frank-Epstein-Barr virus syndrome.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's been an idea that there are some useful publications on this. I mean, you know, clearly we there are immigrants from many countries that come to the United States, and it's something that deserves more study to see how many of them actually fare better in terms of their allergies and asthma in particular, since it's so damaging. In terms, part of it would be a drier climate. So there are people that have claimed that by moving moving to Canada for example, with a colder, dry air, that they do a lot better in terms of their asthma. But there is this possibility too that because we're as infants, we're sensitized to allergens, microorganisms, and other allergenic particles in our environment. And so if we then escape them by moving elsewhere, so if there are different microorganisms present in the place where we move, that it's escaped through that mechanism rather than a drier climate per se.
Okay, well, I guess I better talk about my background. Otherwise, it'll look like I'm trying to hide information from you and perhaps lead you into a trap or something.
Okay.
Because I was involved in a really highly publicized incident back in 1985, and I wound up becoming the first prototype for a new syndrome put together by the Center for Disease Control called chronic fatigue syndrome.
Mm.
And I was like number one, the first.
Wow. How old were you when that happened?
29.
Wow.
So that was a pretty unique thing. And I made up a little poster here to try to draw attention to this incident.
Wow. 1986.
Yeah. Because that's when it really hit the national news.
And was Stachybotrys implicated at that time in 1986 then?
No, we didn't know about Stachybotrys.
Right. That's what I wondered. Yeah.
Stachybotrys didn't enter the medical human literature until the next year in Dr. William Croft.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. The first peer-reviewed paper on trichothecine mycotoxins, specifically listing Stachybotrys. But what happened was the Center for Disease Control, doctors John Kaplan and Gary Holmes, were mystified by sick teachers in sick buildings. And these were even described as sick buildings, but they looked over their list of chemicals, tongue oil, copy machine toner, carpet fumes.
Yeah.
Nothing seemed to serve as a common denominator.
Yeah.
And because I was previously sensitized to mold and had some background in it, I had been in all these buildings that were implicated, I decided I could perform a public service by stepping up to tell people that the common denominator in all of these clusters was this nasty black mold. But of course, when they looked in their literature, there was nothing to be seen. It was thought to be an allergy at that time. But later on, within about a year or so, it finally started to coalesce. And as seen in the my poster, we figured out that there was a commonality to the black mold. And that was later found to be Stachybotrys.
Yeah.
This was just at the exact time when they were changing the name to Stachybotrys chartarum. So there actually was something in the media that could have brought toxic mold to public attention prior to the Cleveland incident.
Yeah.
But because it wasn't in the literature, chronic fatigue syndrome was defined as a vague, nonspecific thing that was probably caused by a virus. And then later, when we figured out what it was and tried to tell researchers, they said, well, that's not in the literature. We've already established this is a probable viral illness. So you have no evidence.
Right, right.
And when we show them the evidence, they go, well, that's just newspapers. That's just personal accounts and anecdotes. It's not peer-reviewed. So we have no mechanism to convey to chronic fatigue syndrome researchers that there actually was overlooked evidence at ground zero for chronic fatigue syndrome, and this has never been factored into the syndrome. How bizarre is that?
So when you say evidence for this link, I'm not refuting, you know, what you're saying about your own case, but when you talk about that there was evidence, what, like a causal link between this fungus and your symptoms. So your symptoms of chronic, I mean, that's it. The medical community as a whole would not accept that as a causal link, that chronic fatigue syndrome is caused by toxic mold, or that toxic mold is one of the causes of chronic fatigue.
Well, chronic fatigue, that's just a term for persistent tiredness.
Right, right. Very broad. Right.
But chronic fatigue syndrome is an official CDC contrived research instrument that was put together by Dr. Gary Holmes and co-signed by his peers in the Holmes Committee.
Yeah.
It was created for the express purposes of identifying, and this is in the preamble to the definition, of a possibly unique medical entity, something that they didn't know.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, since they didn't know about toxic mold at the time, this fully qualifies as a specific thing that chronic fatigue syndrome was coined to solve.
Right. Yeah.
So now we've run into the problem that they don't accept anything that hasn't already been proven. So you can take people to the very buildings that baffled Dr. Holmes, Dr. Kaplan, that the chronic fatigue syndrome researchers analyzed, and go, this is it. This is what we found with the black mold. And this stood out in all the clusters. So how do we get research into this? And they tell us, well, you can't, because it's not in the peer-reviewed literature. Well, it won't be until you come back and study it and write up an abstract.
I mean, one of the critiques that's been put forward, I'm not sure about whether this has been advanced for chronic fatigue, but it certainly has for those cases in Cleveland, was published by very distinguished environmental scientist, Harriet Burge. She is or was at Harvard University. And she did couple of short papers, really. But she was calculating. So she accepting the premise then that Stachybotrys spores or particles could actually are carrying these mycotoxins, that she looked at what the plausible dosage would be when we're inhaling spores, which we do, you know, every breath we take, but in a really mold damaged environment. What's the kind of dosage of toxins that we'd receive in the nose, but particularly in the lungs, where, you know, those toxins could be absorbed by the bloodstream? And her calculations that I found pretty compelling suggested that toxin dose would be so low that it would be unlikely, more unlikely than not, that this would be a, you know, have a toxicological effect on the human body. It's just not enough of this going in.
Exactly. So long as we consider this to be a dose-related illness, but what if it's not? What if it's a cascade of the innate immune system responding to a threat?
I suppose that's interesting, isn't it? Because the another issue is that, well, once you're no longer in that building, mycotoxins, you know, like any other chemical, like any chemical compound or even element, they've got a half-life, so that the body would be these would be removed from the body relatively swiftly. So how then do you have a durable illness then that continues as you're saying in your case, then for decades? But that's interesting. If this the idea that this would be some profound change to the immune system that then would be persistent. You know, it's interesting.
Well, it seems that once the immune system is programmed for a hyper response to a threat, that low levels of exposures could keep the immune system primed in a constant state of upregulation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I find have found a bit frustrating in some of the work I've done as a consultant is, and then you know, I have to have this website. I'll get inquiries from people about mycotoxin testing and doing urine tests for mycotoxins, and my feeling is that in most cases this is not something that people should be pursuing, that those tests are not reliable, they're not really telling you much about
absolutely that's been my theme all along, is that the technology's not yet arrived to where testing reflects what a hypersensitive person can feel.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that makes sense to me. It's and these urine tests are very poorly controlled. I don't know. I mean, we are all exposed to mycotoxins every day, right? I mean, you know this through
absolutely
through our diet mainly. So
most of them don't bother me one darn bit.
Yeah.
So when I use my personal senses to identify the particular thing that's plaguing me,
yeah,
consistently shows up as Stachybotrys. So naturally, I wondered, are there other clusters of chronic fatigue syndrome that were identified as such where the same problem showed up? And in the 1994 abstract, Chester Levine, where they outlined the what was known about chronic fatigue syndrome at the time and its relationship to sick buildings, this particular cluster down in Elk Grove near Sacramento was pointed at as a classic case of whatever this disease process is.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought, well, this is pretty simple. They say it's the same thing. I'll just call them up.
Yeah.
What? So I did. And I go, well, did you find Stachybotrys in that school? They said, absolutely. That was the stuff that was making us sick.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting. Are you still, I can ask, you don't have to answer, but I mean, are you still suffering from symptoms of chronic fatigue then years later?
No. And the way I escape them is called extreme mold avoidance. It was something that I proposed to the chronic fatigue syndrome researchers immediately. I said, if we study this particular irritant that's in the buildings, maybe we can devise ways to get around it, get it off us after we've been exposed, and control our health this way. And they thought that was absolutely insane and refused to do it. But a number of us, not just me, we went ahead and did it anyway. In fact, other members of the original chronic fatigue syndrome cluster initiated the same exact strategy, going out to the desert, getting clear, feeling better, learning what they were reacting to, staying away from the sick buildings, and having such a spectacular recovery that the chronic fatigue syndrome researchers lost interest in them because they go, well, you're no longer sick. You just recovered by a fluke, so therefore we're not going to study you.
No, that's interesting. So you just you spent time in a very dry, hot habitat. That's really interesting. Yeah.
And the incident, the chronic fatigue syndrome, it was extremely well documented, the mystery illness at Lake Tahoe. And there were so many people looking at this, writing about it, that our experience of moving to a different location and recovering, or making a direct concerted effort to stay out of the bad buildings, it was actually documented and put in the chronic fatigue syndrome literature.
Well, that's really interesting. And I see how this, you know, it comes sort of full circle here and how it does relate to sort of me escaping the allergens that stopped me from breathing when I was a little boy in England. Yeah, just escaping that different mechanism, perhaps. But that is interesting. Hmm.
Yeah, you know, the singer Michael Crawford, Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
Yeah, he started to get what was eventually called myalgic encephalomyelitis. Came to the conclusion that the climate had something to do with it, or at least maybe the stress or the pressure of wherever he was at. And he moved to a little country cottage in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Had a spectacular recovery.
Wow.
And I guess he maintains his tolerance sufficiently that he now does what he pleases and goes anywhere and no longer is defined as what you would call ME.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Yeah.
Well, since I've been tuned into this for all these years, I accumulate stories.
Yeah.
And I've got so many of them, I could write a book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, very interesting.
So the question is, how do we get researchers to look into something specific, revisit the history, and put all these pieces of the puzzle back together?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer, as is the answer to almost everything, is sort of show me the money, right? I mean, it would require, not me, but, you know.
That must be something you hear a lot. Show me the money.
Yeah, we certainly did in middle school hundreds of years ago. But I mean, that is an issue, though, isn't it, right? If you haven't got a vast identified patient population, it's really, really difficult to get funding from a company or from the federal government to actually, you know, conduct the research that's required to really look at these potential linkages. So it's.
Well, as you know, chronic fatigue syndrome has grown into a global controversy. People all over this planet are arguing about what is chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet not a single researcher has come back to the very first cluster to ask, what happened here? What do you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I suppose it's possible that it's a description of a whole sort of galaxy of different health issues, illnesses, because, I mean, chronic fatigue, I don't know whether, wasn't the term actually used also in relation to long COVID that we, you know, we're all...
Oh, well, none of the long COVID didn't exist back when the chronic fatigue syndrome definition
no,
was...
No, of course not.
So it couldn't possibly be a factor.
Right, but there are certainly people that describe symptoms that might be might overlap with chronic fatigue as a consequence of COVID infection.
So here's the conundrum. The chronic fatigue syndrome was so specific that you can nail it down to three teachers. Actually, one teacher.
Yeah.
You can go back so far that you can isolate the variables that the very first person investigated by Dr. Gary Holmes was talking about, what he was pointing at. I mean, it couldn't be more specific. But the name of the syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, lends itself to conflation with the idea that you're looking at chronic fatigue.
Yeah, I understand that distinction. Yeah.
So when they say, oh, well, you've got chronic fatigue, that could be anything. What doesn't cause chronic fatigue? You could play tiddlywinks until you're tired and have chronic fatigue.
Right, right, right.
So that's kind of a meaningless construct.
Yeah.
So that's what they did is doctors took the silly name of the syndrome and they put it out on everybody that had fatigue and a headache and tried to reverse engineer that back onto what Gary Holmes was looking at. And it obviously doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
So in science, you start at the beginning. If there's confusion, if you can't resolve a problem, well, you go back and go, where did this thing get crazy?
Yeah.
And nothing could be easier in chronic fatigue syndrome to ask, who was the first person to use that name and what was he looking at?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Interesting.
That was Dr. Gary Holmes, and he was looking at a cluster of teachers at Truckee High School.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't aware.
I'm not one of those teachers. I was a student at Truckee High School, so that's how I knew about it.
I don't know. What state was that in? I'm sorry about the noise I've got outside my window here. I've got being attacked by arborists. They're taking
The outbreak that was investigated was in Incline Village, Nevada.
In Nevada. Okay.
But the specific cluster that scared Drs. Cheney and Peterson the most was a single group of teachers in a teacher's lounge, one room. And how peculiar is it that 9 out of 10 teachers all in one room would get sick when the people in the library next door, the dean's office across the hall, didn't?
Yeah.
This seems like one possibly should look into that room to find out what's in there.
Yeah.
And they did. And there was copy machine toner. They were found to be suffering from a common virus. And then there was this other thing, the toxic mold.
Yeah.
But they looked in the literature, or actually they did. It wasn't toxic mold. It was just mold and microbes in the jute backing on the carpets.
Yeah.
But there was nothing in the literature. So there was no reason for them to factor this into the investigation at that time. But later on, when we found out about toxic mold and said, something got overlooked here, let's discuss it. They go, sorry, we can't do that because it's not in the Holmes definition. So it's really amazing, not just in terms of the mold, the toxic mold phenomenon itself and the emergence of Stachybotrys, but the sociological aspect of how people approach this mystery and how now the answers have emerged, they would prefer that it's not solved.
Yeah, whether there's anything malevolent there or it's the pursuit of some funding, right?
So. Is it malevolent? Is it expedient? Does it serve anybody's agenda? I don't know. So the only course of action for those of us who are afflicted with toxic mold hypersensitivity is to bypass the doctors, for us to specifically go to the places where these toxins are known to be found, have a reaction, go, yeah, that's the stuff. Now I know what I have to stay away from. Learn to do it. We call this mold avoidance. Experience a spectacular recovery. And then I'll become part of the growing number of people who try to convey this to doctors who say, but you've got no evidence, no peer-reviewed literature that substantiates anything that you say.
Right. I mean, there are other physicians, other members of the medical and biomedical community also that tend to exploit people's fears and will claim that they have various almost miraculous cures for their ailments associated with mold exposure. And I mean, that's another side to this. I'm not refuting what you're saying, but it's still a case here of buyer beware, right? Being very, very careful where who you trust. And as I said, in the consulting work that I do with doctors that offer, urine testing for mold exposure, I mean, a lot of this work is I don't find it credible. But
it was known to be spurious from the outset. I mean, we're constantly ingesting mycotoxins. So if you get a test that reflects what we're eating, and yet this wasn't causing the problem, we know that maybe that's not the source of our problem. But if we keep complaining about certain buildings, then the inhalation aspect is what we need to investigate. And there again, the clues that come from hypersensitive people, where we react to infinitesimal amounts, suggest that this is not a dose-related illness. Something about the innate immune response, or maybe mast cell activation, or perhaps T cell programming, has taken over recognition of this danger signal, this threat, now becomes such a dominant force in our symptomology that we have to look at this in terms of a peanut allergy, where mere molecules can accomplish this. And doctors are still looking at this as if, you'd have to eat 20 jars of peanut butter to have a significant exposure. And that's clearly not what is harmful to people who have severe peanut reactivity.
Yeah, in terms of that allergic response, that's right. I was reading just yesterday about allergies to proteins produced by sesame seeds. There's a lot of interest in sesame seed allergy now, too, with food manufacturers having to respond to this. So anyway, just a new... Nothing to do with fungi, but anyway, sesame seeds.
So really, we've had two mysteries going on here. One is the actual mold hypersensitivity phenomenon. And then there's the behavior of researchers in that they're not really carrying through with scientific methodology, which would be take a look at the actual problem. Look back to where this whole thing began, find out what was known, and work the problem as you would any other scientific problem.
Yeah, yeah.
I do have one last question for you, Nick, before we go for the day. I know we're past the hour. So just, it seems like everyone either personally or knows someone that has been affected by indoor molds. Would you say that from what we discussed earlier, the manipulation of our environment, is this what is causing them to become more harmful to people's health?
Well, I don't know that they are becoming more harmful in terms of indoor mold exposure. Molds in the indoor environment have probably always caused allergic symptoms in sensitive individuals. So I don't know that we have the evidence to show that indoor molds are causing more issues now in 21st century than they were in earlier times. But people are certainly a lot more aware of, I suppose, the potential problems caused by mold growths in homes. So I'm not sure.
Well, we've got a bit of a catch-22 going on here in that the incidents, the sick buildings that we've observed, even in ones where people with a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome come flying out of the woodwork at a high rate, the impediment is that because it's not already in the medical literature, it's warded off as being something that we'll find out perhaps in the future, but we don't know now. So each time this happens, it disappears into a forgotten past.
All right. Well, that does it. Thank you so much, Nick, for joining us today. And if our audience members wanted to buy your books or reach out to you, look into your research, where can they do that?
If anybody's interested in more information, look at my website. So it's themycologist.com, because there's only one mycologist, themycologist.com. And a lot of information there. So go ahead. That would be the best place to start.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you to our audience members for tuning in. We appreciate you.
My pleasure. And good to talk to you both.
We want to thank you for listening. Just sending a friendly reminder that what we say is not intended as medical advice, but information to expand your thinking surrounding common situations and issues within the mold community. If you like what we do, please support us by making a donation in the link in our show notes. We also provide one-on-one consultations, products to help with symptom management that you can find in our shop, and a private membership group filled with a supportive community of peers working together to heal from toxic mold. As a friendly reminder, Exposing Mold is a 501c3 nonprofit, and every donation is tax deductible. Thank you so much for your support, and we look forward to providing you with the most honest information out there on mold and mold issues. Please visit exposingmold.org for more information.